Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. We've got a very special guest on the Angus Table that might be quite well known to quite a few Angus members, John Walters. And John is the CEO of Rural Aid. And I'd like to welcome you this morning to the Angus Table podcast, John.
Thanks so much, Scott. A really great opportunity to chat to your members. And no doubt there's a bigger, wider audience out there as well who tune in and hopefully get a whole lot of value out of our conversation.
That's great. There's quite a nice special connection in a weird way between Angus Australia and Rural Aid, and that is one of our directors, who's also one of your directors, Erica Halliday, John.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Erica adds an enormous amount of value to our organisation. She brings that producer's perspective into the conversation every day, and really important for an organisation like Rural Aid that has set up, and everything that we do is aimed to make things a little bit better for producers during those times of disaster and adversity. So it's one thing to think you understand what might be required. It's another thing entirely to have it reinforced from a producer perspective that it's on the mark and meeting the need, or it may be that something can sound like a really great idea and very well intentioned, but not necessarily what's required at a particular point in time. So Erica absolutely brings that into the conversation, into the boardroom, but more broadly, the way which she engages with our team. And I think the other thing I really love about Erica is her story and her just willingness to share the fact that there was a point in time back when that 2017-19 drought was really at its worst that her family needed a bit of support, and they happened to get that from Rural Aid. And so it was almost like a life-changing, would be a slight exaggeration, but it had an enormous impact, and it gave them that little bit of respite from a really tough situation. And so Erica really wanted to do something back the other way. So initially being the receiver of help, and then to be giving help back to the organisation that gave them some support. And that's what she did. She sought to join the board of Rural Aid, and Rural Aid was absolutely excited to have her come and join the team, and it's been incredibly valuable to the organisation ever since.
No, that's great. Erica's certainly a great champion on our board for our Angus community, but also more widely, people doing it hard in a rural environment. My father, when I was growing up, he used to say, you need to work hard, you need to go to church, we're a church-going family, but he said you also should join a community organisation and contribute back. And I think it's a good bit of advice, and certainly Erica lives those principles. And if anyone's ever chatting with Erica, she has a personal story which is not mine to share, but she's always happy to share it in that drought where she received some lovely help, and I think that's a nice one. John, tell us a little bit about Rural Aid. Some people will know. We had a bit of interaction recently with the fires in Victoria. We reached out. I rang a number of members where I could, but it's a limit to what we could do. But quite wisely, we pointed people in the direction of Rural Aid. So, yeah, for those that might not know, John, give us a snapshot of what Rural Aid does.
We like to say we're an organisation that supports farmers first and foremost. There's plenty of organisations that have a wider brief and do an amazing amount of work, whether that's Salvos, Lifeline, all of those different organisations. But Rural Aid, we're really proudly farmer-focused, and that's the first response for us, is to make sure that those farming families are supported. So farmers, their families and communities. And we totally get it that, look, good communities are connected with the farming community, and those two things are interdependent on each other. And when the farming community is going well, that means the local community itself is also doing well, and vice versa. So they're not separate, but our absolute focus is farmer first. And that extends to making sure that when the big moments come along, like bushfires and floods, and drought, which Rural Aid was formed back in 2015 off the back of drought, that we can offer a range of supports that hopefully just take a little bit of that pressure away. We may not be able to solve the big problem, but if we can just take away a moment of stress, worry and anxiety through the support that we can provide, then hopefully that's really beneficial. And that support is typically delivered as hay to feed livestock. And just thinking about the amount of bales that we've moved in 11 odd years, it's probably nudging 200 odd thousand bales of hay that we've been able to get out to people. Household drinking water, just to fill those tanks when they start to get low, that's again been incredibly valuable and impactful. And there's times where filling the tanks are easy. It's getting hold of a water carter to be able to do that job becomes really challenging because they just run off their feet. So 100 odd million litres of drinking water that we've delivered again over a period of time. Financial assistance to be able to put a prepaid Visa card in the hands of someone to meet their needs. And it's a really powerful way of giving individuals the power to go and do what it is that they most need at a particular point in time, because everyone's scenario can be slightly different. Everyone can be impacted by a drought or coming out of a flood, but what people need might be very, very different from one family to another. But with a prepaid Visa card, they can go and use that however it's going to meet their need. And it's not loaded up with thousands and thousands of dollars. It might carry a value of $1,500 on it. And it might be only enough to go and get a couple of weeks' worth of groceries, but it's really valuable, and it just takes some stress and worry away at a particular point in time. And the other beauty of it is it's money then inevitably finds its way back into the local community. And that, again, that interdependence between the farming sector and the community themselves, really, really important, because those local businesses, they get belted as well when these events come along as well, and may not have levels of support from other organisations or government that can give them a little bit of a hand up as well. So put those monies back is really, really valuable. The other, I guess, the key areas is the counselling and the mental health and wellbeing piece. And we've got 10 counsellors who operate around the country. Our model is about seeing producers where we can on their places. And that takes, it just helps break down some of those barriers. So people still can be a little bit understanding or can still be a little bit worried about perceptions or how they might be judged if a mate or a peer or someone else knows that they're off having a chat with the counsellor. Well, we can take that barrier away by putting a counsellor onto their place to have that conversation and just get that really important conversation underway. So they're the things that we really typically do, but we also have a group of volunteers that will go in and work on farms, typically a little bit further down the track from an event, give that family or families the chance to have sort of get on their recovery journey, and then we'll rally 30 or 40 volunteers. We'll go into an area and we'll spend a week on those farms. So that's one of the things that we have coming up at Natty Muck down in Victoria, not far from Horsham there, which is again one of those bushfire impacted communities. Between March 8 and 13, we'll be on those farms and we'll do some of the jobs that sort of get pushed down the priority list but are still important, and all the interactions that come with volunteers and host farming families. They're the typical things that we do, and I guess over time we've found that they're the things that can be most valuable to people during those disaster-type situations. We're always open to other ways that are how we can be even more valuable or useful, and we're hopefully nice and easily accessible because people can let us know what if there's some gaps there that they think is really needed.
Oh, that's excellent, John. That's a really good overview. Actually, my wife and I lost an agricultural business in an industrial fire, and we were recipients of some money to buy a new laptop computer after that fire, and we had nothing, some money for groceries, and quite a few people from our local community helped. And I think from what that's over 10 years ago now. And I think what Rural Aid symbolises to me is a way of formalising the help that rural people have always been very pleased to give other rural people. So I think, yeah, it's great work. John, in the term of scope, what sort of stuff do you have? What sort of footprint are you able to operate on?
We call ourselves a national organisation. That's probably a little bit cheeky in a sense, because we don't have a physical presence in the territory and we don't have a physical presence in Tassie, but we still provide support to producers in both of those areas. And one of the things about Tassie, we're particularly looking at when we are placing our councillors, should we put a councillor down in Tassie? But they've got a great program that operates down there at this point in time. And we looked at it and thought, well, why duplicate something that another organisation is doing very, very well? Let's put a councillor somewhere else where there may be less service so we can be even more valuable and just stretch it down a dollar a little bit further in the process. So the biggest team at Rural Aid is our team of councillors. And there's 10 of those councillors who are based WA, SA, Vic, Tassie, Vic, New South Wales and Queensland.
Okay.
And 10 people, as much as they want to get out and travel as far and wide as they can to see those or have those conversations on farm, it's a bloody big country. And when you've got a couple of councillors in Queensland, for example, you can't be everywhere at the one time. So they do a lot of their work over the phone as well as seeing people face to face. So that's the biggest team in Rural Aid. We've got a lean and mean admin side of the organisation, and then we've got another team who focus on getting the support to people. So if we're going to get hay to someone, that just doesn't miraculously happen. You need people to organise where we're going to source the hay, make sure the hay is of a suitable quality, and then we need to be able to match up the farmers who will be the recipients of that hay and how much hay that they each get. So we have a slightly different model. We don't just get hay and we don't dump it at a location and let people come and help themselves to whatever's been dumped. We try and take a little bit more of a methodical approach, and through that we can, again, really get that hay or that support to the people who need it most at the right time.
That's great, John. Now in terms of raising funds, John, is it principally from donors or how does that work?
Scott, it does come down to donors at the end of the day, and we probably think in two sort of groups. We think as just the mums and dads, the businesses, sporting groups, schools and the like who raise funds and make a donation. So last night I went along to a function at Nudgee College in Brisbane, and it's the boarders at Nudgee who'd raised, through the efforts of the school and the mums and dads and others, had raised $15,000 that they wanted to donate to Rural Aid. And again, in recognition that they've got a really strong boarding base, their kids from Juliet Creek, their kids from all over the place, and they wanted to put a little bit back. So many scenarios like that that we see. And then the other side of these is from a corporate perspective. We've been beneficiaries of some very generous corporates over a period of time, and our most enduring and most generous corporate supporter has been Woolworths, and that jumped on board during the drought of 17, 18, 19 and have been with us all the way through there and just quietly go about offering their support, and we're very, very grateful for that support too.
That's really heartening to hear that, John. That's excellent, and that's it's pretty nice to hear that kids at a school are getting together to raise more than a few bucks. That's really significant, John.
Absolutely. And look, just in course of conversation, one of the young fellows that I met on that night was from up at Julia Creek, and we played a very, very small role in getting a little bit of hay in through to Julia Creek earlier this year off the back of the floods. And he just wanted to come up and say, thanks for what you do. Hey, we've lost quite a few cattle in that particular event. And just saying thank you. And here I was saying thank you to them for what they'd done. And he wanted to come back the other way. And it was just a nice moment to know that the things that you do make a difference.
Oh, that's great. John, through the conversations, and not that Erica shares anything specifically, but she'll say that you're entrusted as an organisation with, you know, amounts of money at a time where you've got to be good stewards of that. How do you, as a CEO, manage that? And is there, what can you share in terms of the good stewardship work and the planning you do to make sure the money gets where it needs to?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. And I guess it's the thing that we put highest on our priority list is the word trust. So it's that donors can trust that when they make a donation to Rural Aid, that those funds will get to those people who need it most at the right time and in the right form. The other side of the trust piece is when we ask producers to register with our organisation or reach out to our organisation to make themselves a little bit vulnerable, I guess, by default, by saying, you know what, a little bit of help would go a long way, because we know that's not necessarily an everyday behaviour. Too many times we probably hear people say, well, help someone else and they need it more than I do. So at the end of the day, that's the thing that guides us, and we ask ourselves, if we were to go down and do a particular approach to solving a problem, would that be the best use of the funds that we've been entrusted to get to people? And if it doesn't meet that most basic test, we just don't do it. So, and that's, I guess, why we've continued to offer the supports that we have, because we can very efficiently get hay to people. We can very efficiently get financial assistance into people's back pockets. We can provide a need around mental health and well-being that we really believe there's this gap there that needs to be filled. And we're not going to go and duplicate what might be available through other services. So it's the first test and the most important test that we ask ourselves every day, Scott. And then after that, it becomes around what do you do in what order to make sure that when we're working with producers that we're not part of a problem that might be happening. So when floods are happening or bushfires, we don't want to be on the ground until basically those emergency services say, well, it's now gone out of a response situation into a recovery situation. When recovery starts to occur, that's when we'll typically sort of swing into action and make sure that we're being supportive at the right time and not getting in the way of people fighting that fire to keep the bloody families home safe, or while they're busy trying to move livestock, they don't need someone from rural aid knocking on the door or ringing up or getting in the way of what they need to do. So, yeah, I keep coming back to the point, the right assistance at the right time and done in the right way is really, really important to maintain trust as well.
John, I imagine, like recently, the fires in Victoria, you must be sitting there a weekend and trying to have a weekend off, and then all of a sudden a crisis comes out of nowhere. How do you and your staff manage that? Because I imagine sometimes things are long and slow, like a drought. Other times, a fire happens instantly. How do you manage that with your team, John?
It was a classic one. It was the start of this year, wasn't it? Really, the clock ticked over to 12:01 on January 1, and there was a situation unfolding in northwest Queensland with the floods up there. And so we try to keep a really close eye on what that's looked like. I guess everyone relies on good information, and so we try to keep an eye on different weather services and providers to get information that helps you make good decisions, just like your members do, and just like anyone involved in agriculture does. So much as it is driven by what happens with Mother Nature. So you want to be looking and preparing the best that you possibly can. And a lot of our messaging through November and December was all about preparation. There were some forecasts coming through from the Bureau and others, the high risk of bushfire, high risk of cyclones in the north and the like. So what is it that we can do as an organisation to help people get a little bit ready for that? So that's part of what our messaging looked like at the time. And then when those situations do occur, we quickly look at, well, how do we play a role here that doesn't, again, get in the way? How do we support those services that are on the ground doing what needs to be done in the here and now, and then complement that? So, again, the bushfires is a classic example down south. We get down there, we get on farm, we get into communities, we'll go to recovery centres, we'll be as visible as we possibly can so people who need help can see us and know that we'll be there to do whatever it is that we can.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I imagine it's as good a planning as you can do. Still, sometimes it must be really hard to react when some of those events unfold. Yeah.
We take our hat off to producers because they're the guys who cop it, and we're just there to try and help them get through what they do. So I know people try to move cattle. I know people have tried to build some mounds to raise up some country post those 2019 floods. Talking to a lot of people post this event, that sentiment has been that if we get another flood event, then what will we have done differently from what's occurred now to what might occur in the future so that we can mitigate against that and not to be as vulnerable as Mother Nature might make them at different points along the way. So lots of thinking there, and just really conscious of this, again, it's the producer who bears the brunt of it, and we're just there to try and help and support the best way that we possibly can.
Okay. John, how long have you been at Rural Aid?
I joined the week before COVID, so that was back in 2020, and rolling around to 6 years, and it's honestly, it's been the fastest moving 6 years of my life. I've loved every minute of it, but it feels like we've just really rolled in from one end. It was drought, coming out of drought back in 2020, coming out of bushfires, coming into floods, and that's just been this revolving one disaster event after another, throwing a mouse plague in there as well. And it's just been a pretty constant time, but a really important time for Roulet, because it's in those times when things are really tough, that's when we as an organization really need to stand up, and that's when we really need to shine, and that's where we need to be really good to just take away some of the worry that those people who are living it are experiencing.
What's your background before coming into this role?
Used to be one of those journos who was a terrible speller, and so I started as a journo. Glenys is my hometown. Finished school and got a job on the local newspaper there, and world's worst cadet, and had the most understanding of editors who helped get me on my way, and really fortunate to find myself a little bit later down the track working at Queensland Country Life, and an amazing publication with incredibly skilled, capable, knowledgeable, passionate journalists, and absolutely loved a career in media that sort of stretched in different areas at different times. But it's, yeah, I just love media. Not probably so fussed about social media and the role that it plays today. I'm probably a bit old-fashioned, and give me a newspaper any day of the week.
Well, that's good, and certainly Country Life would be pretty good preparation for this role, John.
Fantastic. And I really looked at it at the time and thinking, sort of had the opportunity to meet a lot of people, to make some fantastic acquaintances, some fantastic friends, and some great relationships through my time at Country Life and through my time at Rural Press and then Fairfax and Australian Community Media. And how could I take the skills and the contacts and the knowledge into my role at Roulette and add some value to an organisation that was doing great things? But it also needed to continue to grow and make sure that it was really well positioned for what was coming in the future with these bigger, more frequent disaster events that we're experiencing.
That's right, John. How do you? I guess you've got always dealing with emergencies, and then how do you carve out time to think strategically? Where does the organisation need to go next? Is that a challenge for you?
That is probably our single biggest challenge, to be really frank, Scott. We're really good at responding to what's occurring around us, and we're really good at making sure that the things that we've decided that we need to be as an organisation, we're really good at the doing part. Thinking a bit strategically is probably the challenge that I have as a CEO, is to lift yourself out of that operational stuff and get up here and really look down at the organisation and look at the horizons and say, well, what do we need to be doing to be able to still be relevant in 5 years? Is what's occurring now going to set us up, or is what we're doing now going to stop us being the organisation that we might need to be in the future? So Erica and our other directors at Roulette, we've got a really fantastic board of directors. They pose those sort of challenges back to me as the CEO and say, well, we want you to be thinking a little bit more strategically at points in time. And they're a board that certainly bring that strategy focus into the everyday for us as well. So I think they do their jobs really well, and they're helping me do better from a strategic perspective, to be really frank.
I imagine, John, you've got competing priorities at times. So you've got a bucket of resources that you have got to operate. How do you, as a board and yourself, balance where should this dollar go today? And do you sometimes, I imagine there's never enough. I would say that's one of the biggest issues you'd have is you're fighting on several fronts. How do you manage that? And is it a difficult decision matrix?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably the reason I've got so much grey hair and increasingly less hair, because we do worry about those exact challenges. And part of it is we've got this real focus on just the mental health and wellbeing challenge that exists on an everyday basis. So if you want to be good in supporting and helping people through that, you've got to you've got to be a known and trusted organisation. And to be known and trusted, our perspective is you need people on the ground who are visible in communities, who are seen every day, who seem to be people that don't walk around saying they're a councillor, but they're someone who's just at the sale yards, or there's someone who's at that at AgQuip field day, or there's someone who's at the New South Wales Farmers or the Ag Force meeting, and they're at those meetings that they're seen and known. And so for us to do more of that, we need more resources on the ground to play that role. But as we know, when you put people into an organisation, it comes with cost financially. So for us, it's balancing the cost of, do we put more councillors on the ground? And if we were to put more councillors on the ground, does that take away a little bit of our capacity to maybe put some of those prepaid Visa cards quickly into the hands of people immediately after a disaster event? So it's always that waiting, which one, the chicken or the egg, comes first. I don't know if there's a right answer to that question at the end of the day, but we're finding when we're getting really good support, like we did through the Southwest Queensland floods this time last year, effectively, we're able to get in and provide hay, we're able to get in and provide financial assistance. But one of the things that we're really proud that we've been able to do as well is off the back of the donations that came through that period of time, is to appoint a councillor who will spend the next 3 years just circulating through all those impacted communities to make sure that they're supported. So he'll spend his time travelling Quilpie, Thargo, Yulo, Adavale, Windora, all those sorts of places, just being visible to have those conversations with people. And I think in that situation, we've been able to get a really nice balance, help quickly and rapidly when it was needed, but some longevity through a councillor who can help people in the context of maybe their recovery journey, but just help them with the everyday challenges. Like we often sort of think that, put disaster aside, people have got to worry about rising costs. They've always got the fluctuating prices. You throw a personal health scare in there. Look, there's the succession plan that's urgently needs to be finished but hasn't been started. And they're just the everyday. And people need support in the context of that as well as they do in the context of disaster. And that's what we can do by putting really capable, accredited councillors into regions and into communities.
John, I was speaking with Dougal Purcell recently, and you know him, and he's with Victorian Ag, and one of the challenges they had was supporting their staff in the field with while the crisis is going on. Is that also a tough one that falls into your lap a bit, John? You've got people out fighting the good fight, but I guess making sure they're okay and making sure they're able to do their job. Is that something else that is a tough one?
Yeah, absolutely. And increasingly, isn't it? Like it's that psychosocial health piece. And I know every employer has a really clear obligation around that. That's the way the world is. And whether that was an obligation or not, I still think we had a responsibility to make sure that we're providing that support to people. So our counsellors, from a professional perspective, have an external qualified third party that they can debrief with to help them. They still have their internal processes around debriefing and managing those situations as well. And then our team, like the person who picks up the phone, is often the person who's at the very front line of some of those really quite upsetting calls along the way. So we're also very conscious around that, and we make sure that our people get a training to help them there, and then they get that ongoing support. So in later in March, we've got a professional expert to help us, just across the entire team, just deal. How do you debrief? How do you unwind? How do you manage yourself against the backdrop of having just constant conversations about tough times, and so you can come through that without being weighed down by it yourself? So really important stuff. So it's a great one to flag, Scott.
Mm. John, where do you see the organisation going over the next 5 years? You might not be able to share that completely, what's your vision going forward? You're on the board.
We sort of talk about Rural Aid as an organisation, and we're thinking out to 2030, which seemed like a long time when we started the journey, and here we are in 26, and we're 4 years away from the strategic sort of work that we've been doing one of the areas that we really want to focus on is just growing the organisation. So that's growing the number of producers that we can support each day, each year. It's growing, hopefully, the number of producers who put their trust in the organisation by reaching out to us. So we've got about 18,500 producers around the country who are currently registered with us. We'd love to see that grow to beyond 20,000 for a couple of reasons. It amplifies our voice when we go to a government leader or other to be able to say, look, this is the sentiment that's being expressed by the cohort of people that we represent on a daily basis. It gives us the desire to then go out and say, well, gee, if we're going to have 20,000 farmers registered with the organisation, we're probably also going to need to be able to grow the level of support that we'll need to be able to meet that demand that may well come from that. So it one sort of triggers the other and just keeps us very focused there. And just the constant one around what else might producers need from an organisation like Rural Aid? And it can be really practical stuff. So like watering points in flood impacted areas, they're things that typically get heavily, lots of damage sustained and a lot of potential cost for people. So is that something that Rural Aid can play a role in there? What else might we be able to do to connect people to other service providers? And we've done a little bit this particular year working with GiveIt to identify, we don't help people put a new lounge or household goods into a house that's been destroyed by flood or fire. But if we can connect the producer to an organisation like GiveIt who can provide some of those pieces, then again, we can take away a little bit of stress and worry for people and we can hopefully just accelerate their recovery as well. So how do we be more strategically playing in that assistance space, even if it's not something that we directly support? So there's a couple of areas that we want to focus on. And then just probably like everyone on the land, just how do you make sure that the information that you're getting is the best possible information to allow you to make the right decisions at the right times? And I guess we keep looking at the Bureau and those other climate information providers, because that's where so many decisions start and stop. Do you sell on cattle? Do you buy cattle? How much country do you plant to crop? All of those sorts of things at the end of the day are decisions that are governed by what's coming from a rain wise or other. So our organisation's in exactly that same boat. We want good information to make good decisions. Where do you get it?
Yeah, okay. John, you look back over that period of time, it was your tenure. What's a time where you're really proud to be the CEO of Rural Aid, where you thought you really kicked a goal with helping people?
I wouldn't put it down to any single moment, but there's been so many moments where individual producers that we've helped have passed on that thanks that it made a really big difference. And the young bloke at the Nudgee Borders dinner from Julia Creek who says, hey, thank you for what you guys did to get a little bit of that hay through to us. Like, that's gold. Being down in the Hutter Valley at Singleton and a dairy farmer that we were doing a bit of work for says that the conversations that he's been having with the councillor were life-changing conversations for him. And I still absolutely remember his words, because he said he was a little bit broken on the inside. Mm. And he said he'd get up each morning and he's put on his smiley face because he thought that's what his family needed from him. Mm-hmm. What they really needed from him was for him to be the best version of himself that he could be. But he couldn't be that until he recognised that he needed a little bit of help. And he went in and got that help, and it came via a Rural Aid counsellor. And it completely changed his outlook and the way that he goes about doing things. When you hear conversations or get that feedback from people, that's the stuff that really matters at the end of the day. And collectively, that adds up to just recognizing that the organization does have an important role to play. It does good work. We still want to do a whole lot more good work, but those little moments, Scott, little moments matter.
That must be pretty heartening. That's absolutely. That is a nice story that you. You must feel like when there'd be one great thing about working for Rural Aid, you make a difference every day, and I think that would be very encouraging.
Yeah, totally. I always say, look, you can't change the world overnight, but you can make it a little bit better each day through the actions that you take. And we see it with mums and dads who reach into their pocket to give rural aid $50. It's probably $50 that they need themselves, but they recognise that someone else needs it a little bit more than them at that point in time, and that's what they do. All sorts of other ways that people go above and beyond, and we're lucky to be almost like this conduit in the middle between people who might need help at a point in time, between people over here who want to make a difference, and here we are, we sit in the middle and we direct the traffic in both ways, I guess.
Mm. And John, you'd have great encouragements, but you'd also have some pretty tough decisions at times, and you may not want to share any of those, but what has been some of the hard patches along the road, John?
That's a good question, Scott. I don't think we've ever said no, like a flat no. Like people will come to us and say, can you do this? And it may not fall strictly within our wheelhouse to be able to offer support of that nature. But if we talk about it a little bit more, there's inevitably a way that we can play a role to help. And that's what we try to do. So I don't like to say no. I just like to say, well, how do we solve the problem a different way? And yeah, there's certainly plenty of tough moments along the way when you're knocking on doors. Like one of my jobs is to knock on doors of different organisations and say, you know what, do you think there's an opportunity that we might be able to do things together for the betterment of someone else? And asking is not always an easy thing, and I find it sometimes challenging to ask. And so I totally get it when producers don't want to ask for help as well. So I totally relate to that. But if you don't ask, you also don't get sometimes. So and sometimes you do need it, and you do need to ask the question. So it's probably not the greatest of examples, but that's probably where my head straight away gravitates to.
No, that's probably a pretty good answer, John. For yourself, have you had mentors along the way that have helped you grow into the leader that you are today?
I just think I've been incredibly fortunate, Scott, along the way, and I've sort of mentioned being the world's worst cadet journalist back at the Glenannis Examiner in 1984. But my editor at that time was an incredibly patient, amazing woman. And I sort of lobbed in the front door and she said, can you write me a caption for this photo? And I said, well, what's a caption? So I think she was pretty worried on day one on who'd been appointed to the role. But she absolutely helped me get the first inklings of what that job required and what your responsibilities were as a journalist. And when I moved to Armidale to similarly work on the Armidale Express down there and the New Englander newspaper, similarly another editor down there. And she was, again, a really clever, helpful woman who, again, just got me on my journey and just pointed me in the right direction on the things that she needed to do. And I've probably been really, really fortunate throughout my career that there's been some great people along the way and some great colleagues to work with in media, whether they were mentors or not. They were just bloody good at what they did. They knew how to write a great story. They did it in a very respectful way. I think when you're in that environment, it rubs off on you. And so I'd like to think doing things respectfully that build trust and allow relationships to flourish, I think they're probably the things that I've really taken out of it. They've all come in slightly different forms, but that they probably roll up to what I've taken from all of that over a fair whack of time.
No, thanks for sharing that, John. That's it's great that you had time at the Glen Examiner with the big Glenannis, and it was certainly an institution in Glenannis. I don't think we overlapped in Glen, but the Glen Examiner was certainly an institution for the community for a long period of time.
Absolutely,
John. In terms of where do you fill your cup up from? Is there any books that you leadership books or resources, or I've got to be careful now and ask. I'm probably showing my age about when I'm talking about books because I think not everyone is a reader anymore. But yeah, where do you, or is there some resources that have been helpful to you that you could share?
From a book perspective, I love to just switch off and escape rather than sort of getting into too much leadership and growth development type things, which I probably need a lot of. But I don't, I sort of go probably in completely the opposite direction, and I don't know, I'm a bit of a fan of Trent Dalton, and some of his books have been pretty darn good. I've really enjoyed those. I read a book called Bridge of Clay, and it was written by a guy called Marcus Zusak, I think his name is. And he wrote another quite famous book, which I can't remember the name of it, but Bridge of Clay's story about this group of brothers and their growing up together and some of the challenges that they'd experienced. And I don't know, just lovely story. And I sort of grew up in a family with four boys where you'd spent 90% of your time belting each other and all the rest of it. So I could probably relate to a little bit of that. But it was just it was a great story, an uplifting story, but with a little bit of adversity along the way. And maybe there's some parallels there with Roulette as well, just a little bit of adversity thrown in there. But there's hopefully an out of that, and some good comes from that. So, yeah, and that probably sums it up, I reckon, Scott.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's great. We always ask everyone on the podcast, John, what's your best beef eating experience? I haven't struck a vegan yet, so I apologise if you are one. But, what's your best beef eating experience?
My goodness. Like, I love a good steak just on the barbie at home. I sort of default to a good bloody sirloin steak bloody every day of the week. The guys at Stanbroke have been very generous towards Roulade, and I remember they given me a little piece of Wagyu rump cap, and that was very, very enjoyable. Like, I'm not sure if I cooked it the way that it would have been cooked in a good restaurant or a better, more capable chef, but I tell you what, it was magnificent. And I think the other steak that was really memorable was our patron is Mrs. Gina Reinhardt, and she had one of her 2GR Wagyu steaks, which was really enjoyable as well. But you can't go past a good piece of Angus beef either, Scott, can you? So, yeah.
Thank you. No, that's great. That's lovely that Gina's involved. Has she come along to some of your organisational events as well, John?
Yeah. We have a bit of a what we call a long lunch in Brisbane, which is all about trying to bring that agribusiness community together out of Brisbane, Queensland. And she's joined us on a couple of occasions there. She's a bit of a force to be reckoned with in the charity auction, as you could imagine. So it's say to people, it's no shame if you see yourself going head to head with Mrs. Reinhardt and she comes through as the successful bidder, you should be pleased. So no, look, she's been great to have at those rooms, and she brings a real gravitas to a room when she's there, and she's very approachable as well. I think she enjoys a good conversation with a good switched on producer about what it is that they do and how they do it.
It's very encouraging when people have done well, like Gina, give back, and I think that's encouraging to an organisation like yours. Jordan, that probably leads us to, how does someone get involved? They might have listened to this morning and gone, gee, good organisation. What can some of our members do to contribute, John?
And a great call out, Scott. For anyone who might be thinking, look, been impacted right here and now with what's occurring in Victoria, and we're really, really conscious of just what a tough set of circumstances are presenting down there with the bushfires, but it's bloody dry down there as well, and we're really, really conscious of that. And I know there's other parts of the country similarly very, very dry. Southern New South Wales has been a really intense spot for a period of time. We know our South Australian mates have had or experiencing a really long, hot, dry summer off the back of 24, 36 months of tough conditions. So just give us a call. It's as simple as jumping on the phone and just saying, here I am, this is who I am, this is where I am. We might just ask for your primary producer number, and that's what we need to help us understand that you are a legitimate producer. We want to make sure the support that we provide goes to legitimate producers. And it's as simple as that. On the flip side of things, if you feel that you're in a position to, and you'd like to contribute towards Roulade, then we're really open to how that can happen. And if you're running a stud, you might say, well, I've got a bull or a heifer that I might, when he goes through the sale ring or she goes through the sale ring, I'll donate the proceeds of that one animal to Roulade. We did a really cool thing with Bryce Cam and his family at the Wonga Plains feedlot where Bryce and his family fed a mob of cattle for Roulade. So when they're taking on in their next intake, 50 of those cattle were earmarked for Roulade. We paid for the cattle. Bryce fed those cattle and looked after those cattle for us. And when they were sold out the other end, the proceeds of that transaction came to Roulade. And it was this beautiful, seamless way that business as usual for them doing what they were doing. I'd like to think maybe that's a concept that could be replicated by other people running feedlots, and it can be five cattle or 50 cattle or whatever the number looks like, we're very grateful for whatever that might be. And there's a whole lot of people that are a whole lot more creative out there than I'll ever be, Scott, and they might have a ripper of an idea, and let's talk about it.
It's great. And so if any of our producers are listening today and you've got an idea there, or you've got a spare animal that could be a nice contribution to rural aid, please get in touch with John. He's excellent. Or give Erica a call and talk about an idea. I think that'd be great to see some support for rural aid. Anything you'd like to, getting towards the end of the podcast, John, anything you'd like to just mention to the Angus community while you've got a captive audience?
I've got nothing specifically, I don't think, Scott, other than just we're here. We'll always be here. A phone call, that's all it takes. 1-300-327-624. Give us a call. Really happy to chat. Like you, we just continue to watch what's coming down the weather channel and what that might mean for us. If there's things that you feel that are gaps that would be really helpful, let us know those things. Just like you, you're running a business that you're looking to continually improve and make it a better, more successful farming enterprise. We're not too different to that with what we do at Rural Aid. We want to be better and more relevant. So help us be that organisation through your feedback. Very grateful for the opportunity to talk today, Scott. Very grateful for the opportunity and the way in which you've helped support our work, particularly again in Victoria with just inclusion in your newsletter and inclusion on your website. Those things are really important. I think it helps demonstrate to your members that we are an organisation that's worthy of their confidence and their trust, and we won't do anything that puts that at risk. And we just look forward to meeting as many of your members as we can in the months and weeks going forward, hopefully in a positive context, not in such a tough set of circumstances, but be great regardless.
Oh, John, thank you. And I just want to, on behalf of the Angus Society of Australia, thank you for the work of Rural Aid. Thank you for your personal work. I'm sure while you worked for Rural Aid, you'd go, from what I understand, above and beyond all the time. So thank you for your heart for country people and being able to help them. There's nothing more important than helping people when in their hour of need. So, no, thank you, John. Thanks for your willingness to come onto the Angus table and share a bit about Rural Aid's story. So thank you very much.
Good on you, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.